All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? What is happening? I'm getting old. We're all getting old. Every day goes by, we're a little older. Not bad. It's not bad. But, you know, closer to the end. How are you? I'm sorry, man. It's just, it seems like there's been a lot of past guests passing away lately. It's bound to happen. I mean, you know, people get older and we've been doing this a while. I mean, we've been doing this over a decade. Some of the people we talked to were old when we talked to them, but some of the people who are passing away now are not that old. And it's scary and it's sad and it's the way life is sometimes, depending on how hard you live or the choices you make or just genetics. Sometimes it's shorter than you want. Other times it seems to go on too long. But that's an outsider's point of view. Today on the show, listen up, it's W. Kamau Bell. He's been here five times. I think he's got the record because we don't do repeats that often. This is the fifth time he's been on the show. It's actually for good reason, people. He directed the new documentary miniseries, We Need to Talk About Cosby, which I watched and I thought it was great. And I wanted to talk to him about the sort of process of his thinking around it, because he's pretty well inserted in the thing. He's part of it. It's his own questioning in a lot of ways that drives it. And there's some people that have been on the show in the documentary talking about Cosby, historian Cliff Nesteroff, Chris Spencer, Godfrey. But it's just it's a provocative and it's a very thorough in a certain way, thorough in the way of the history of Cosby, but also thorough in its enabling the survivors to tell their stories and for you to hear them in a way where they're relatively comfortable and not like on a witness stand or in a uncomfortable situation. And it speaks a lot to give the survivors that much of an outlet to really relax into the trauma and the story. But all in all, it's very provocative, and it really is challenging to people that loved Cosby, which is a lot of people. And it really is about trying to figure out what you do with the monster up against the guy you loved when you were younger or grew to look up to. It's a very good documentary. And I talked to Kamau about it. We were up in a hotel room in San Francisco. He lives in the Bay Area. It was one of those situations where, you know, I don't do a lot of those kind of interviews, you know, on the road. I've done a couple lately. You know, I did Roy Wood Jr. and I did Kamau, and Brendan was with me with Roy Wood. But it was one of these things where, you know, we got to talking and I realized about 5-6 minutes in that we weren't recording it. And it was one of those moments where I'm like, fuck, God damn it. I'm like, okay. He's like, I get it. You know, we've all done this before. Yes, we have. Let's start again. The frustrations of being out in the field doing the interviews. But we got it, and we had a great talk. It was. I didn't know how long it would go on for, but it was good. It was good to touch base with an old friend and good to hear about this work. I mean, the process of making a Bill Cosby documentary, the people that wouldn't talk to him, how many people he had planned to talk to. Also, you know, surprisingly, Bill Cosby gets released from prison before they finish recording. Challenges, but it's all in there. And we kind of give the background in this conversation. So I was talking about death and dying and aging. Yes. My dad is, I'm going to go see my dad this weekend out in New Mexico, check in with him while he still is aware of who I am. But I got a lot of friends who have aging parents. I guess I'm fortunate. I guess, listen to me, what an asshole. I'm fortunate that my folks are still alive. I can still talk to them. But you see it coming, man. You see it coming. I guess we all know it's coming, but when you see it coming and people are passing away here and there. And I find it's kind of tweaking my brain in the way where I'm like, I gotta make sure I'm doing everything I want to do that I can do right now. All I know is I'm exercising too much. And now I've gone on a bender of Girl Scout cookies that I didn't even ask for. They were sent by Kit's sister. I'm not complaining, but I am kind of, because, you know, I'm going to have to throw them out. I have nothing against the Girl Scouts. It seems to be a tradition, a noble undertaking, but, you know, fuck their cookies. Am I right? I mean, because, you know, you're going to get a few boxes if you buy them, because, you know, it's really more about helping the Girl Scouts out. Give me a crate. You know, I'm just trying to help you guys out. But secretly, you're just feeding the monster. I got all the kinds. I got all the kinds. All right, so look. Kamau Bell is the host of the United Shades of America on CNN. The documentary series We Need to Talk About Cosby is now available on Showtime. He directed that. And I thought it was necessary to talk to him about it. I talked to Chris Spencer a bit about it. And then Kamau, you know, thanked me for talking to Chris Spencer. And I'm like, why don't I talk to you, man? So this is me talking to Kamau about his documentary, We Need to Talk About Cosby.
Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
All right, so I watched a documentary, and I realized that on some point, at some level, this was a personal reckoning. So, like, what, yeah, you know, what drove you to do it? Like, were you sitting around for, like, 2 years, you know, thinking, like, you know, someone's got to deal with this? I'm not sure that the comedic community, the black community, the community at large is really processed properly the conundrum of how we feel about Cosby. Is there a way to still like the specials? Is there a way to still like the records? Yeah. I mean, was that what it was? Were you festering alone for a year and a half, 2 years?
I mean, I think I've been festering since I first started, quote unquote, making it in show business.
Yes.
And every reporter would be like, you know, so who are the comedians you liked growing up? And we're talking about when I sort of broke through, it was like 2012, 2013.
Yeah. Right.
At a time where it was like, you couldn't just say Bill Cosby and keep it moving.
Right.
And so for me, it was like, as a kid who grew up in Bill Cosby's America,
yeah,
and was the perfect age for The Cosby Show, and Bill Cosby himself is the greatest stand-up special for me. I never was a Pryor guy. I was always like, no, that's the way, that feels closer to me.
Yeah, that's, I guess that makes you like Cosby, kind of.
That's the only way I will take that. So it was definitely a thing where I was wrestling with it, because I'd have to do these interviews with people, and they'd be like, and you'd have to go, how do I say Bill Cosby without sounding like I'm like denying all these accusations?
Right. So, okay. Right. Okay. So then you decide that you're going to do it and you pitch it?
I mean, it just, like I said, it's not like a thing that I was like, I went to pitch 9,000 people. It just happened to be the weird thing about, if you're in this business long enough, you know, sometimes you end up in the right room at the right time.
Okay.
And so I was talking to the producers from Boardwalk.
Right.
We were having a wide open conversation about comedy docs.
Right, right, right.
And the idea came up, well, how would you do a comedy doc about a comedian who fell? Cosby's what, the top of that list. And I had always thought, in my own, when I saw Ezra's Made in America, O.J. Simpson, that's how you'd have to do Cosby.
Right, and I talked to that guy.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that thing was something.
Yeah.
And like,
I mean, I think personally, it's like, it's one of my, I've rewatched it several times.
What was it, four parts, right?
Five parts, seven and a half hours. Yeah.
And what was it about that thing that you thought was so amazing?
Because all of us went in going, why would I want to wait to see a 7.5 hour OJ doc? Like, he was not compelling enough as an individual.
Right.
But when you look out at America and go, here's what America was doing at the time, I'm always interested in that. Like, yeah. I'm always interested in, like, how did America sort of create this circumstance, accelerate this circumstance? And then it also had like a lot of deep dive stuff about LA that I had no knowledge about, like Johnny Cochran's young career,
right.
Watts, like stuff that you'd be like, why is he telling me about Watts? OJ's not from Watts. And
right.
then you would go, oh, but this is interesting.
Well, but how much of it was about this idea that, you know, he is presented and what, because it seems to me that with OJ, that the difference between the black and white reaction to the verdict, what was different. And there was a certain amount of like, you know, who cares what the truth is?
Yes.
He's ours and you can all fuck off.
Or not even he's ours. Who cares what the truth is? He's black. You can all fuck off.
Okay, well, that's, like,
I think
I mean.
Some of it was ours, but some of it was like
just black. Period.
Just the fact that this is you couldn't get this black guy.
Right.
You've gotten a lot of us. You can't get this one.
Right. So that, you know, and I think in that sense, when you're dealing with Cosby, and I think it was very careful and not careful, but correct of you to say like he wasn't just a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
Cosby was everybody's guy.
Yeah,
and that was part of the strange thing about his personality and how he designed it.
Mm-hmm.
And right? And and also like there comes to a point where it's like, does he even want to be a black guy?
Does he want to be every black guy's black
right.
guy? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But so what was the original concept for structure?
I mean, I didn't think I would be narrating it. I didn't think it would start on "Hi, my name is" the right. way it starts on.
Interesting.
I thought it would be sort of like OJ Simpson. I was really like looking forward to the opportunity to step behind and not be in something. And so it was really like, oh, I'll get to actually just be a director because that's what I want to do.
So you were going to just line up a bunch of guests.
Which is what, like go get all the people who would do it who were, and also let's remember, Cosby was in prison when I started this. So it was like, I thought, oh, we can have the discussion now because he's going to either spend the rest of his life in prison or he's going to get out as a very old man. And so I felt like maybe the time is right for the discussion.
Yeah, we can get away with it. Behind his back.
Behind his back. I thought he would know about it, but I didn't think. Well, let me be clear about this, because some people have asked about this. It's not a conversation with Bill Cosby. It's a conversation about Bill Cosby.
No, I get it. And you know, because, but you thought, so how did the booking go, the guest booking?
Well, I mean,
I know you got a lot of Gottfried. I was like, there's Gottfried. He's the best thing that's ever happened to Gottfried.
God for Gottfried. Thank God for Chris Spencer.
But I didn't know Gottfried had
he was part of the CBS Cosby show that was after the
Cosby warm-up.
He was the warm-up guy. So yeah. So when I found that out, I was like, oh, he's connected. Also, Gottfried is an outspoken comedian, so I know he'll have stuff to say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's not afraid of.
And he can do impressions.
And he can do a good Cosby impression, which we didn't know we would be so excited to have. But then I was like, let's sprinkle that throughout. It's great to hear. But
here's my problem, knowing, you know, because I'm a comic, you're a comic, and I'm watching this. There were moments where I'm like, good for Gottfried.
Well, I was like, I hope good for Gottfried, because he's also experiencing the backlash or blacklash. So
is there?
Man.
There
are a percentage of black people, first of all, but certainly a percentage of black people who either they don't believe the survivors, which is its own problem in my mind, or they believe them, but they sort of do this math of like, it is better to have the good that he did than the bad that he did, so I got to ride with him. Like,
well, I think that was a driving force, it seems, from watching it, was that, you know, to give the survivors real time.
Mm-hmm.
And also for them to have the opportunity to talk about the one thing they all talked about was like, when I heard her, I was like, oh, it wasn't just me. When I heard her, because that's pretty damning.
Mm-hmm.
When you got five or six of those.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think that anybody in one sort of lump or one sort of context has heard any of those survivors go at length, unless you were in the courtroom or wherever those things were.
Or you were their lawyer.
A deposition of some kind.
Yeah.
So, and I thought too that the natural thing, the natural humanization that happens
mm-hmm.
when, you know, you can sit there and watch somebody talk or tell a story and the nuances of those things. Yeah, I found that to be, I don't even want to use the word damning, but because this isn't a trial, but it was sort of like, there's no reason any of these women would make any of this shit up.
And especially, a lot of this happened to them 30, 40 years ago. Like, why would you still be riding on a lie like this?
Well, and a lot of them didn't even want to talk about it.
And to be fair, like, a lot of them were like, the only reason they thought they would talk about it now is because they were like, they believed in, they'd seen my work before. And they're like, well, if anybody can pull this thing off, it's you, is what I was being like. So like, they were like, I'm going to trust you, which is why, even though I often wanted to quit, I was like, I can't do it because these women have trusted me.
But what were they trusting you with? What did they, what needed to happen that wasn't happening? I know that you're saying there's backlash and there's, yeah, I think that the worst thing that happened was, you know, once he got put in jail, you know, there was like, okay, that's done with. And then, and also there was an apathy in general after a certain point.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that they, that we were trying to pull off was, and that they had to agree to, because they had to understand, is like, we're not just going to talk about the assaults and the rapes.
Yeah.
We're going to talk, you're going to be in a thing that also talks about the good he did.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Which is a very different thing.
You had to present that to them.
This is not Surviving R. Kelly, which is a doc that I was also inspired by for this. It had to be like, look, you have to understand that there are going to be portions of this that are about the good he did or his career in a pot that will be come off in a positive way.
Yeah.
But also, if you want to, you can weigh in on that stuff, which some of them did. So like, I was pretty blown away that like we have like Lisa Lott Lublin or Lily Bernard, who are both black women, and even an Eden Turl, all black women who are all able to talk about like the good stuff. And so the first time you see them on screen, they're just sort of like, yeah, the Cosby Show was great or whatever. And you don't know that they're also survivors because we don't ID them as survivors at that point. So it was like, you have to, and some of them were like, I'll be in this, but I don't want to talk about any of the good stuff. Fine, fair. But with many of them, we were able to like, so the audience doesn't even know who they're hearing from until the stories happen.
Now, who were the people? So how many people do you reach out to that were like, no, like, you,
I mean,
we talked before a little bit, yeah, before I realized I wasn't recording.
Sure.
That there were a lot of comedians. Like, the idea was like, you know, I can cover his influence on comics by talking to comics.
Yeah. Like, I had this idea that like, because really, like, I really, a big part of this for me was to really talk about Bill Cosby himself as an important comedy statement. That was for me, which is why I had a hard time throwing it all away, because like, I'm still inspired by that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't come to that till later in life.
I remember that. Yeah.
Oh yeah, we talk about that. Yeah.
No, I mean, I've heard you talk about it.
Yeah, like you know, I never really dealt with Cosby that much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had the records and stuff, but it wasn't, and I never watched the Cosby Show much. I did. Yeah. I knew him, and
you were a little bit outside of that for a couple reasons. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I don't remember watching much TV. Maybe it was not my age group. Like, yeah. I've seen maybe four episodes of Seinfeld, and I'm not being, you know, like,
you were out in the clubs at something. That point. Yeah. You weren't trying to, you weren't home on Thursday. You were Thursday nights featuring and headlining. You
something.
Weren't
yeah, doing yeah. something.
Yeah.
I just didn't watch your regular television, you know, since I was a little kid, but. But when I finally sat down and watched Bill Cosby himself, I was like, what I got out of it was, you know, oh, you decide.
Yes.
It's like, mm-hmm. there's no rules to funny. It's like, you want to sit down and tell your story? You decide what's funny and make it funny.
You want to take your time?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you just want to like get there when you get there and think about the audience secondarily to the thing? Yeah,
yeah, but you know, there takes a lot of confidence and sort of focus to do that and deliberate. But I get that. Okay. So
I thought I would have a bunch of different comedians, and there's been articles written of comedians talking about how great it is. So I thought, we'll get the comedians from that article to talk about it. And it was just those that didn't know.
No. And no, but these are people you know relatively well.
Some of them. I mean, some of them, either I know them relatively well, or I know they know who I am because we've interacted on occasions, or people who I've reached out to. You know, some people you're just cold calling, reaching out to. But yeah, it was. And then people who, all levels. Like, I just want to be clear, like, it's not just, it was like, yeah, but it was just people that I thought, oh, they'll do it.
So what did they say?
I mean, I think there's a variety of reasons to get here, but it basically, what it boiled down to is like, this is too thorny. This is too, there's not like, I don't know how to get in here and get out safely.
Was that surprising to you that it was thorny?
It was surprising to me at first, and then after more people said it, then I was like, oh, I'm the one who didn't get it.
Huh, what do you
like,
mean?
Like, I was naive. Huh. Like, I came to this too naive to go, oh, no, the Cosby's in prison. We can talk about this. And then I realized, oh, I'm one of the select few people who thinks this way.
So there's still, like, and I guess I'm going to keep hammering this, but...
Yeah, please do.
But there's still part of primarily the black community that's protective of his legacy.
I would say the comedian community. Like, the black community specifically, but I'm talking about comedians of all, like, of lots of different racial groups.
Okay, but fine, but I don't quite understand what they think's going to happen to them. That, you know, it doesn't seem like Bill's got a lot of friends that are going to cause any damage. That was the weirdest thing about all of it. It's like, no one's standing up for this guy.
Well, I
in
mean,
show business.
Well, but they're also, I think they're also not coming after him. They're not also not, they're not like standing on top of him either.
That's right.
Yeah, they're like, they're sort of
he made
just
a
like,
lot of people a lot of money.
He did. And also it's just easier to go like, oh, that thing happened. And it doesn't come up in your regular conversations because nobody wants to talk about
it. Yeah, but the one thing that you weren't really able to get at was that, as we have learned over time, is that none of this kind of shit happens in a vacuum.
Well, yeah.
So, but no one was willing to say like, oh yeah, you know, everyone knew. Mm-hmm. There was, I don't remember in the documentary, you know, everyone, you know, people talked about that assistant who was a facilitator, but that's it, man. And, you know, and you've got to assume that more than him knew what was going on.
Well, I think that's the thing we got to around the Cosby Show, that it was like, I think a lot of this was sort of two things. One is framed as infidelity, which I think
and he's a fuck around.
Yeah. So, okay. And who are you going to be mad at? If you're mad at that guy for fucking around, like, you just look around. Yeah. So I think a lot of it, and I think that helps cover up a lot, I think. Framing it as like, just like covering it up as the casting couch with Weinstein covers up a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this is the thing we do here. Everybody's in on it. You don't understand that, like, no, many of these people don't want to be in that room.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it is that.
It and must have been creepy, dude.
That's
a certain point.
I mean, when Joseph C. Phillips, who was in The Cosby Show, and Lily Bernard, who was one of the survivors, talks about the parade of women after the rehearsal, a parade of women would just parade to the green room and just sort of line up outside of his dressing room, and one at a time go in, and just sort of like they would close the door. And I think one of the Stephen Watkins, one of the stage managers, says his door was always open except for then. And then you hear Lily Bernard's story about being sort of escorted into his dressing room, and he sort of, you know, grabs her, and she sort of just doesn't know what to make of it. You imagine how many times did that happen, and how many times did that person not get out the way that she did?
All right, so you finally start seeing, you know, who's gonna, you know, show up for you.
Yeah,
and you know, it's Godfrey.
It's Godfrey.
Chris Spencer. Yep. Wayne Fetterman as a historian.
Wayne Fetterman. Wayne Fetterman
as a historian.
Great. Thanks,
and,
Wayne.
And then Cliff, who you know I talked to,
who
a lot.
I learned about through you.
Cliff Nesteroff. Now, okay, so these are some of your guys.
These
so
are
now,
the comedy people.
Right. So once you start in on this thing, you know, how do you outline it? Where do you start?
I mean, it very clearly from the first meeting that we had about it, it was like we knew even though you don't want to do things chronologically, it just sort of felt like his career is so massive that you got to lay it out. And then you can jump around within the chronology, which we do a little bit.
Well, that was kind of genius, where you had either actual photographs of the women or these suggestive sort of avatars, silhouettes, you know, that you fit into a timeline.
Yeah.
So you can kind of see like when it accelerated, when was, you know, at his most predatory and, you know, how many women were involved. Because like those numbers are there, they're available. They're
yes.
You know, he's a pretty prolific rapist.
Well, and I think that's the thing for even those of us who believe the survivors, you don't ever see it laid out.
Right.
And you sort of goes, it's been more than 60. And that just sort of number just sort of sits out there. But to look at it in a graphic, in which we decided at the end, I was like, we have to see something that really puts it all together.
And also the weird thing is like, you know, when you see numbers on their own and you just think Cosby 60, 70, it's like, how is that even possible? It's like, it's possible.
Yeah.
How long does that shit take? Well, you're talking one night, 1 hour in a life.
Yeah. And you're also talking about the fact, I don't think we all realize it went back so far in his career.
Right. But like, it's like, you know, like if you're doing that and you're out and you're in environments where that can happen and there's 365 days in a year, 60 is even like, it's not that big a number, man.
Well, as Renee Graham says, if it's 60 who've come forward, it's probably more.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So, okay, so you start chronologically. And what are the first sort of, as the guy who you present yourself at the beginning of this thing, is like, look, man, I loved Cosby. We all loved Cosby. Mm-hmm. America loved Cosby. Look at his amazing career. He's the first black guy to be this black guy. Mm-hmm. He was the first black guy to be that black guy.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, we all loved him, and the white people were starting to love him. This guy was amazing. At what point during the process of unfolding this stuff or unpacking it, and then presenting yourself as the guy who's like, I'm wrestling with how to contextualize or recontextualize Cosby in my heart and in my mind.
Yeah.
So what were the first obstacles? Like, where were you? You were like, oh, fuck, what am I doing?
Oh, well, okay. So for the first obstacles is realizing like, okay, I'm not going to have I'm not going to have A-list comedians or lots of comedians in this. I'm not going to have a lot of people who worked with him. And I had conversations with people who, with comedians who worked with him, great conversations that ultimately ended up in no. I'm not going to have, so the thing that like I think Showtime wants, and I want, but really, is like you're not going to have a poster with a bunch of famous people's names on it to sort of go, look at all these people who showed up for this.
Yeah.
And then a pandemic hit in the middle of all this that we like the challenge of like, how do we still make this? The idea is we're going to fly around the country to a bunch of survivors. We're going to spend a lot of time in Philly. How do we do that now that the whole world is shut down? Mm. And so I think those two challenges in particular were the ones of like, and then like, will we get enough survivors to show up? The survivors ended up, and that was through my producer Geraldine and Katie King and Kelly Rafferty, that they like really, the survivors were actually ended up being the easiest people to recruit. We didn't get all 60. We didn't expect to, but we got enough from different eras that it felt like we could build out the picture.
Are there out name? Are all those 60 names out?
Some of them are Jane Doe's, right. but I would say most of them, as I understand it, are out there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I think we were also trying to be careful to like, but some of these people came forward and then never came forward, like said their piece and haven't gone out and done a lot. So we didn't want to be like, go look these people up, you know, so you can go find them, but we don't want them to feel like we're bringing it. Cause they all talk about the negative attention they get from it. And so some of them have really said, I don't give a shit. I'm going to be out here and do activism based on this.
Yeah.
But a lot of them, I think were like, I'd said what I said and I'm not saying it. I'm not going to take the heat anymore.
Yeah. I'm not, that's not going to that's be
not,
my life.
That's not, I'm not going to be defined by that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So the obstacles were the pandemic, you know, the not getting support or contribution from major names in show business. And then, so what makes you go on? Because like when you talk about the OJ doc.
Yeah. They got almost everybody.
but you're also talking about the a kind of a reframing of the story in a way where you're forced to, as an individual of any color, you know, to reckon with, you know, what is really the evidence, right?
Yeah.
So on some level, I took it when you said we need to talk about Cosby, that in some ways it was a direct appeal to the black community to sort of like, what are we doing?
Well, I think it's a direct appeal to people who, specifically the black community, because it's very clear that there's pieces of this doc that are about black folks, and I'm talking to black people directly. But it's also like, again, he was America's dad. So all of us who grew up in that era and sort of took him in as our dad, or people older than me who just was like, that's my guy, white, who is like, that we need to all talk about Cosby.
Okay, I guess, you know, in as I'm saying it over and over again, I'm realizing, well, maybe I'm being, like, because I don't, like, we are all looking to, like, not just the comic community, but, like, white people are looking to, like, what are you black people going to do about it? How we,
That's not, and it's not just our problem.
No, I know that. Yeah. But it's a natural thing. You know, like, what is the reaction? Because like, but what is, what, but it seems that media will always go that way because what is it? How do you generalize the white reaction to Cosby?
I mean, I think that the levels of reaction are just different. So I think, like, this is what I'm saying. You could find me a very famous white comedian who, of the right age, so we're not talking about somebody young, but we're talking about somebody who is a famous white comedian who exists in the world, and go, do you want to talk about Bill Cosby? And that guy's going to say no, because he's also under the umbrella of Bill Cosby. So for me, when you say that we need to talk about Cosby, for me, it was this thing where, like, I feel like these conversations are happening either not at all, or they're happening in segments. And we have, and I feel like there's value in having the whole conversation. Now, for some people, they don't want to have the whole conversation. Well, luckily, there's other programming for you. But I really felt like there is a percentage of people, a large percentage of people, who are like, I haven't been able to have this conversation or figure out how to have this conversation. And embedded in this to me is like empathy for survivors and help. How do we change the structures so that this doesn't happen again? Because it's not like the industry, despite what we think would happen during Me Too, things haven't flipped in a whole new way. The industry hasn't been rebuilt.
So in terms of, is there a way for the two, you know, for the two realities or experiences of Cosby, you know, pre, you know, revelation and post, you know, acceptance of said revelation, to still have a place for this guy that can exist in those two worlds?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the question.
Well, for me, it's not even a question, because I can't remove Cosby from my cultural black man DNA.
Yeah.
I can't remove the good stuff.
Sure.
There, so I think for me, it's like, how do I then live with it? Because I can't act like, well, I'm just going to pretend like I wasn't inspired by Bill Cosby himself. I'm not going to think about all the good things I got from watching the Cosby Show. I can't do that. So, but I think there would be this idea that like, well, now that he's done this, you have to do that. And it's like, it's not possible. So how do you then live with it is the question for
and
me.
And did you realize that was a question that you were seeking to answer before you made the doc? Or did that sort of evolve?
I mean, it started on the whole, I mean, I think it started on the art versus artist thing. And then once we got into it, it was like, that sort of felt like sort of like low hanging fruit. And really it became about like, how do we stop this from happening? How do we create more safety here? How do we believe survivors sooner?
So that whole argument sort of exists in the world. It's not even an argument. It's like, you know, either you're going to be able to still appreciate the person that turns out to be horrible because they did some amazing stuff, and you're going to be able to separate it. In terms of retrospect, the stuff, amazing stuff they did still has any credit to it, mm-hmm, who mm-hmm. knows, right? So you're dealing with that. I mean, even on some level, you know, there have been people trying to kind of like, you know, Martin Luther King to some people gets a little murky.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's, he was a human being.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Not as murky as Cosby.
No, yeah, but it's not murky. It's a human being's one thing. You know, yeah. It's sort of like, you know, the road's the road.
Yeah.
But a rapist is a rapist.
Yeah, no, this, and I want to be clear, I don't want anybody to listen and think but Martin Luther King was a man. He's a man, and he was a popular man who was apparently on the road as popular men are.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's different. I mean,
yeah, for sure. We've tried to be clear in that like, we're not making this doc if it's about infidelity.
Right. No, this is about a sociopath and a predator and a rapist, right? So
it's about consent. It's about not respecting consent and infidelity.
That's diplomatic. Yeah. Yes.
But I'm saying infidelity implies consent. This is
right.
Not about
right.
That.
Yeah. It's hard to ask for consent when someone's unconscious. But okay, so when you're laying out the history of Cosby,
mm-hmm.
because this is stuff that pre-existed your life and my life, you know, we were mm-hmm. young, mm-hmm. you know, and whenever he makes his first break, that was like
62, 63 is when he starts getting on late night TV.
So yeah, that's when I'm born and you're not even an idea yet.
Nope. Parents haven't met yet.
So this is something you've got to look at in that editing room, you know, as you're building this thing, it's sort of like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
You know, and then sort of make the connection.
Not even the editing room. On my computer in my house with files being mailed to me because of the pandemic.
Right, the history of Black America alongside of what he's doing, because there's a way to approach that critically as well. In that, you know, some people spoke to it. I don't remember the woman's name about that. He wasn't addressing it, but ultimately his existence.
Yeah.
Is addressing it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And then after that, his actions are very progressive in the name of the community.
Well, and also that's the thing. I mean, the first story that made me sort of feel like somebody's got to tell this story, and this is where before I thought I would ever get the opportunity, was after, in the wave of all the accusers coming forward, the survivors coming forward, I read an article about this woman named Noni Robinson, who's a film director, who's directing a film about the history of Black stunt performers and how she
that was
did,
an interesting sideline, huh?
Yeah, that to me, that's where this starts.
Yeah.
As a like, how do, like, because a lot of this could be boiled down to whether I don't want to be about, do you think Cosby's funny? It's not about that. It's about what do you think about his career,
right?
And he specifically during when he got I Spy, he saw that they were using a white stunt performer to do his stunts,
in legitimate
blackface, painting his arms black and everything. And he said, "I refuse to be on this show unless you get me a black stunt performer." And the people in the stunt industry, the black stunt performers say that's the moment things changed.
Yeah.
It wasn't about like, oh, that was a piece of the thing. That's the moment things changed. And so for me, it was like, okay, that's bigger than whether or not people think he's funny. That's actually a part of our history. And she had a documentary that eventually is going to come out now, I guess, but like that she couldn't figure out what to do with because she'd interviewed Bill Cosby for 2 hours and felt like she couldn't use that interview now because of all the stories of the accusers. And so it was like,
where's she at with that?
I think because of our film, she feels like she can figure it out. So it will come out because I think it's an important story.
The point where it's like Bill Cosby gets black people jobs
and didn't go take credit for it, didn't get a headline for it. I've talked to many people.
White people do.
Yeah, exactly. But also you would think in the mid-60s, you might be a black guy who wants to get some good press.
A champion of
and
the cause.
He didn't do it. And this is, you know, so I think that was just, and to me, I'm like, people who don't know this story, and this is an important story about Black history.
Right.
And also he did these other things, but how do you, you can't let that story go.
But that was sort of an interesting kind of like coincidental sidebar, you know, like you were like, wow, that were, how'd we get here? And you find that woman who's got this other issue with Cosby.
Yeah.
So, all right. So you're moving through this stuff. And
that's what I learned from Ezra's piece, like how to take, try to, how to, how, can you take sidebars and get back to the main road?
Sure. And can you put somebody into a historical perspective and it doesn't overwhelm, you know, the
fact that the, we're talking about
the balance
awful.
You're trying to maintain.
Yeah. I was always thinking about, like, I would say to the editors and the producers, we always have to remind people that another shoe is eventually going to drop. We can't make people think that, like, we tricked them into watching a different documentary.
But you, like, present, you know, the stunt thing, you know, his becoming a leading man, becoming, definitely the black-white line was, you know, it went away for him to a degree.
Yeah.
And all the stuff with Poitier. And then, like, then at some point, you start to drop the timeline in.
Yeah.
When did this other thing start happening? Yeah. Or also you said, oh, I remember what I was going to say, is that you really started to build his family life.
Yeah.
That he built this family life.
Yeah, and publicly built this thing. So, yeah.
Well, that was the other thing, is that there was that subtextual argument of the portrait of a sociopath, which is like, what was, you know, compartmentalizing and just him, you know, was this all a front to facilitate his base intentions?
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard argument to make, but you definitely posit that as a psychological assessment.
Well, I think Jelani Cobb puts it the best. He's like, people want to make this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but there's an argument that it's all Mr. Hyde.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think we can, I really was like, I'm not going to try to answer that question because I'm not in the position to do that. This isn't that level of, this isn't true crime. It's more like, how do we deal with all these pieces? And I just want to have the audience go, let's just sort of sift through this stuff. And let's see where we come out on the other side. And we don't have to come out in the same place as long as we agree that these things happened. I don't think anybody is necessarily capable. I'm not capable of diagnosing him.
Well, no, I right. Yeah, there's people that are capable.
I'm not. But I just feel like as a person who's making this, there's lots of arguments that are presented in here.
But I guess, you know, in that sense, you know, like with psychological assessment or framing it, you know, as all a sham, you know, what precedent is set for assessing, you know, people in general and artists in general and people, you know what I mean? It's like, is it better just to say like, well, you know, he had this mentally ill problem, but do you need to say that, you know, Dr. Huxtable was just all, you know, that was just so he could rape people?
Well, I mean, this is where we start to dig through what we call the breadcrumbs of like, isn't this strange that he could have any job on the Cosby Show that he wanted to have.
Okay, yeah.
like just where you go.
The gynecologist.
OBGYN.
Oh, yeah.
And where's this? Where's his office? It's TV. It could be anywhere. It's in the basement of his house. It's just to me, or it's like, okay, one Spanish Fly joke in the 1960s. Hey, swinging 60s. What's family friendly is different.
Yeah.
But on Larry King, we've all seen that clip.
Yeah.
He makes the joke about Spanish Fly. And he's an older man at this point. It's weird he's still telling this joke. You think he would have aged out of this joke. And then what we found out during the series is that he was there promoting a book called Childhood that has like several mentions of Spanish Fly in the book.
Uh-huh.
You're like, this is just a lot, man.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, like, to me, it's like, that's what I think when you start to dig through and find these breadcrumbs, you start to go like, this doesn't, what is it? Is it like that because you're doing these bad things that they just sort of leak out of you because you can't stop them? Or is it because Cliff at one point says he's a narcissist?
Yeah.
And I don't go, that's right, he's a narcissist. But I feel like Cliff is like saying, this is what I see from this perspective. Because if I do it, it's not bad. And you go, well, that's one side of it. And then Jelani Cobb says, maybe it's all Mr. Hyde. Maybe it's all maybe you know you're evil and you're sort of doing all of this manipulatively. I don't know what the answer is there, but I do know that all of this exists.
That's true, and maybe I'm being a little too critical of that assessment because, like, you know, entertainers, they're not, you know, really moral, known for moral integrity in general,
but Mark, I would say you don't claim to be a moral authority, and we have a man here who claims to be.
Well, that's
authority.
The next twist, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that this evolves into this other thing?
Like, we all sort of accept, and I'm not in any way indicting, I'm not saying anything about, but we all accept that Richard Pryor was probably not the greatest dude. You know what I mean?
Of course, but like with that, but
because
he'd be the first to tell you.
But that's the difference right there, is that Richard Pryor sort of owns his, like, I'm not the greatest dude. And I've told you about I'm not the greatest dude, and I shot
Mike. How many times do I got to tell you?
Exactly. Like, and so we sort of have room for him in ways we might not if he was also saying, I'm the greatest dude.
Yeah.
Whereas with this Cosby story, that's why I think it gets into this sort of like, well, what's really going on here? Because it's a dude who told us he was the greatest dude. And told us he wanted us to be the greatest people.
And then, you know, made you realize that there's no way you can be great.
And like then when you say there's sexual, that there's women who claim that he assaulted them on the set of his show, on the set of his children's TV show Picture Pages.
Oh my God.
That's exactly it right there. Oh my God. Like, it's just like, how does all this live in my head? And to me, I always thought of this doc as like, once we got into it, once Showtime was like, there was just sort of the idea of like, okay, there's not all these famous comedians in it, or all these people couldn't directly connect to him.
Yeah.
Then it was like, then Kamau, you have to be in this.
Right.
And so I was like, do I? And I talked to my wife, Melissa, and she's like, yeah, you do, because otherwise it's not going to hang together. So I sort of, the most nervous I think I've recorded for VO in my life was when I sat in my wife's closet, because this was the VO booth, going, my name's W. Kamau Bell, and I'm a child of Bill Cosby. Because I was like, I'm gonna be at the top of this thing.
Mm.
Like, I didn't think I was gonna be at the top of this thing. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm aiming it all at me now.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the thing that I sort of really want the doc to be is like, this is a bunch of smart people who have thought this through, who are sensitive and empathetic. Because I don't want those people who are not. And if you have a Bill Cosby conversation, these are all different versions of the Bill Cosby conversation.
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, you could actually see some, I don't remember exactly who they were, but there was a sense of inner struggle.
Yeah, because a lot of them are black people around my age. Yeah. Like, so that they like went, they have gone through it in the same way that I've gone through it.
Right. Yeah. But they did come out on the side of like, damn.
Well, which to me is like, again, that's, if you don't come out on the side of damn, I don't know how to bring you into this conversation.
Now, how was it in terms of how many survivors are in it that you spoke to for like what seemed to be a long time?
There's in the first episode, Victoria Valentino is like the main survivor. Then in the second episode, there's Patricia Steyer, Janice, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
In the third episode, it's Lily and Eden Turl. And also Lisa mm-hmm. Lott Lublin. And yeah, and then there's other survivors we talked to in the timeline. So there's probably, but those are the major ones.
And how'd you handle those interviews? I mean, what was the, were you nervous?
Yeah, the very first interview you did was with Victoria Valentino, who was in the first episode.
Yeah.
And we were all like, and that was actually in person. A lot of these interviews were not because I was in my house. But so we were all, the whole crew was like really like up on our toes, just sort of like, she's going to be here in a minute. Everybody ready? Like, sort of like, dudes, act right. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, sort of like, and they were all cool. But it was just like, okay, when she comes in, we don't know how she's going to be. Give her a space. We set up a green room for her. We bought her flowers. We did, like, it was very much like, let her tell us what to do. Let's take the mm-hmm, keys. Mm-hmm. And Victoria walked in like, hey, everybody. Like, it was just like, she's giving hugs to everybody. Yeah. She gave me a copy of her Playboy magazine. You know, she asked me questions about United Shades. She was like, all of us relaxed.
Oh, good.
And then we sat her down. And then when we sat down on the couch, I was always very clear that before we get into anything with Bill Cosby, where are you from? What do you do? What's your life like? What was it like growing up?
Yeah.
And then the more you, and this is what I've learned from United Shades, the more you do that, then by the time you get to the thing, people are actually more open to the conversation.
Yeah, because it's just a thing in another thing in the conversation.
You're just built, and they know you're building to it instead of like being nervous at the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then what happened is inside of that, we got stories that we didn't know we were going to get because we just took more time. And so that conversation was over 2 hours, the first one. And we didn't know, my producer who talked to her, Geraldine, didn't know that her son had died so close before she met Bill Cosby. That came up in the conversation. And
horrible.
Yeah. And then we also, all that stuff, I wanted to get all the stuff about Playboy from her because she'd been a playmate and a part of the Playboy clubs. And I was like, oh, we can actually use this stuff in the stuff we talk about the Playboy and Hugh Hefner. So, but you just sort of like get all this extra stuff that I was really clear on. I want these women as much as possible to appear for the first time not connected to Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
So you just go, this is just a voice. Oh, she's an expert. She worked at Playboy, you know.
Yeah, a full other story, yeah.
Yeah, at the time we got that Victoria one, and then the rest, most of them were done, Lisa's was not, but most of them were done over Zoom, and it was just, you sort of like, am I going to be able to get that level of intimacy over Zoom? And it's weird, but you did. We did. I mean, you've done it here with the podcast.
Yeah,
so
you can.
You do. You just sort of like, everybody's aware it's Zoom, and you sort of make jokes about Zoom, and you say, oops, I'm muted, and you sort of like, just sort of like, you know, go into
you
it.
You stay focused, and if there's not other people in the room and stuff, you can kind of hold it.
And everybody, like, everybody knows what they're there for. So, it's, and we were very clear by the end, like, because we had to hire a lot of, like, day players to do the, just because it was COVID, we couldn't get the same people. And you just make sure everybody who comes through the door knows what they're there for and knows how to be as invisible as possible. And, you know, but, like, I interviewed, like, Gloria Hendry, who was the first Black Bond girl. And she was just having a great time.
Yeah, she's great.
And she stood up and did the thing where she, like, nobody asked her to. She just stood up and did the thing where she bent over at the table.
Yeah, with the
and,
Playboy thing.
And there was like a boom opera in the back, and they're like, oh, we should have her do it again. And move. I was like, I don't care at all. Just let these people be.
Yeah.
My whole style of interviewing for me now is just let these people be. Don't try to manage them into an answer.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so all the survivors, like, they by the time they decided to show up, it was just clear that they had already done the work to be there.
Sure, and they had grounded themselves and done whatever mental preparation.
They've done enough of these things where they sort of like, the more comfortable, the more you make it clear that you're not here just for the sad part, the more they relax.
So, like, when Cosby takes that turn, like, and I don't know the timeline of Cosby, but, you know, when he made that speech.
Pound cake speech.
The pound cake
2004.
Speech. 2004. Yeah, that, you know, changed, you know, everybody's mind about him.
Lots of people's,
like what? So by the time, you know, Hannibal, you know, somehow dumps this into the world in a way that resonates.
2014, yeah.
What is the feeling about Cosby in general?
I think, I mean, this is funny because when Cosby does the pound cake speech, me, like a lot of Black people my age.
What year was that?
2004.
Oh, wow.
Which was the same year that Andrew Constand came forward and said that he had raped her. So it's like all of this is happening simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
But generally, most of us are looking at the pound cake speech and not really paying attention to this Andrew Constand.
Yeah.
So when he does the pound cake speech, I remember Kevin Avery, we were both like, oh, this is such a bummer. Like, it just felt like, oh man, like he's, and you know, we know a lot of older Black people who get conservative, but you're like, not Cosby.
Uh-huh.
And it felt so mean. Like, it didn't feel like, tough love.
Because this mockery. Is a guy that you establish throughout the documentary as being a guy that is concerned with educating and is an educator.
And believes in all of us, not just the ones of us who are doing well.
Right. And then all of a sudden he turns into this.
He turns into like an, you know, if he went from being America's dad to Black America's angry grandfather.
Yeah,
and like making fun of the ways in which Black people name their kids. And one of the names he uses to make fun of them is Muhammad. You're like, that name? Like of all the names to like choose to like say. And, it, you know, and so it felt out of touch. It felt like a dude who was super rich and was almost bitter about the fact that, didn't I tell you all how to get super rich?
Yeah.
And you're not all super rich.
There's a bit of that going around these days.
Yeah, it is. I think it's more of that than we realize. Yeah. I told you how to get super rich and I told you how to rise out of your poverty and you didn't do it. And now I'm mad at you. And that was also, it sort of sucked because there was a significant portion of the Black community. When you listen to those clips from the pound cake speech, there's Black people in the audience cheering and clapping. So it's like, it's not just, so I don't want to be, it's not just that Cosby made all Black people mad. He sort of created a rift in the Black community for the first time in his career.
Right. But also that was, you know, the same sort of rift that Chris Rock artfully
very much
explored.
And it's funny because I did a documentary about Chris Rock and we talk about Black people versus that bit.
Yeah.
And man, I don't even want to say it because now Rogan's ruined the N-word. But the idea being that like...
Oh no, you guys got to take the N-word back?
We got to take it back.
Again?
He's ruined it for me. I'm not saying he's ruined for all of us. But the idea being that like Chris, and he says in the doc that I did with him, I'm of that community. So when I'm criticizing it, they know I'm a hip hop guy. I'm not a guy who's
so he's not coming at it.
He's not coming at it from an outsider. Like from Cosby does not live in the
rich,
community anymore.
Old man.
No. Right. And Chris would even admit like he wouldn't do that bit now because he's not, he's a different guy. But when he did it, he was a dude who was in Brooklyn a lot, and people saw him around, so he wasn't a dude who was, and he was also very much tied into hip hop artists that are doing the same thing in there. So Cosby, it was like, it came out of nowhere. It came from like you, every time we'd seen him up to that point, he was telling us how to do better and that we could do better. And it felt like he was reaching his hand out to us. And that was the, and also this is the thing I think is so critical. He wasn't turning on all all parents in America who were doing poorly. He was turning on black moms.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like he was like, a lot of you parents out here are mecking up. He was at the NAACP turning on generally black moms who were struggling and their kids.
And that was sort of like, that was like the a big, what would you call it, disappointment?
Big. Yeah, it was like a seismic shift, but in sort of like how we saw Cosby. But I saw Cosby do stand-up twice after that, because when you saw him do stand-up, he wasn't doing that. Like, me and Avery went and saw him.
So again, you have to accommodate these different sides of Cosby?
We were at our, and this is what I think Hannibal did so well, is that we were allowed to, because of the media landscape, and we're not on Twitter, and social media is not telling us what to, like, what, you're allowed to sort of go, okay, I'm going to see this Cosby. I'm not going to see, I'm not thinking about the Cosby who has these rape allegations. I'm not thinking about the Cosby who's doing pound cake speech. I'm just going to spend 2 hours with this guy talking about his grandkids and his wife and the remote control, which is what I did at the Paramount Theater in Oakland.
How was that?
It was great. He closed on the dentist, and everybody laughed like we'd never heard it before. Like, he literally at the end of at the end of his bit, he just went, "The dentist," and we all went, "Yay!"
Wow, he knew his shtick.
Yeah, and then Hannibal goes, "No, you're not allowed to do that anymore. You're not allowed to think about these things separately." Not but that he
that didn't like now, like when I heard that stuff or when it finally got to me, I was surprised. I didn't know anything. And first, why do you think at that moment it picked up?
I mean, I had heard these, because by then, by 2004, Andrew Constant's case had been around. There had been other women who had come forward. So, like, I definitely was one of the people who was like, yeah, I don't know why I haven't been able to put these I don't know why. I'm sorry. I haven't been able to put these things in one place in my head.
Yeah.
I think it was like, it's just the perfect storm. Hannibal, he's a black comedian. He's in Philadelphia. YouTube is a thing now.
Yeah.
Cell phones can now get video footage.
Yeah.
The person who got the video footage was also a journalist. It was just like the perfect storm of
just
like,
happened.
It couldn't have happened any other way. If there's no cell phone footage of it, maybe the story gets out, but it doesn't play the same.
Did Cosby ever comment on Hannibal?
He has generally commented through publicists, but I don't think he ever, I don't remember him.
Well, there's that one weird bit in when there's the art collection was being shown.
Yes.
Wasn't he asked about Hannibal?
He was asked about, he was at the, so him and Camille, so it's like there's this period of time when Hannibal does his bit, and then, but it's before the accusations start coming forward in mass. So there's like a few weeks in there.
Uh-huh.
And so Cosby and Camille were hanging their art up at a museum, I think in Philly, but they were, or maybe in D.C., they're giving their art collection to the Smithsonian, I think, or lending it to them. And it was just like, Camille and Bill, and everybody's excited to talk to them, and it's Bill Cosby, and again, nobody's thinking pound cake, it's just America's dad is here, and we're all
with his art
and with his beautiful art, and they're talking about it, and they're smiling, and there's all this footage of them smiling together, and journalists smiling with them. And I remember hearing on NPR Scott Simon go, he's talking to them about the art, and he goes, "Mr. Cosby, before I let you go, I have to ask you something." And we have footage in the thing of, not of Scott Simon, but an AP reporter doing the same thing. Like, "Before I let you go, I have to ask you something."
Uh-huh.
And it's about, there's a comedian, and I don't think the guy that we have in the piece doesn't even get Hannibal's name out on the thing.
No.
He's like, "There's a comedian who did," and Cosby's just like, no, we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
Which is one thing to say, but then he then tells the guy to scuttle it. The word he uses is scuttle it. Don't use this bit.
Where's your man? Where's the producer?
Where's your person? Yeah. And then he does the thing at one point. He goes, "Huh?" to somebody who has clearly said nothing. And they're like, "What? We need to talk to his person immediately."
Yeah.
And you can feel.
He barely changed his tone, but his intensity and just Camille sitting there, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
What kind of like gaslighting insanity? You know, like, you know, like, what does she know? What she doesn't? You know, Judd Apatow did the most amazing joke about that. Did you hear him do it?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. "Camille, do you like your life?" It was like, I'll forever, you know, whatever judgments you have of Judd as a comic.
Yeah,
that joke is like, he's good with me.
And you know what? That's one of those jokes that like probably needed to be done by a white guy. Like, I don't know that a black guy can get away with that joke. Like, it's like
she's
one of those.
Like,
things.
How does she not know? Is he hiding newspaper? You know, like.
I mean, we have the little section in the doc where I asked everybody who was like, "Did you know his family? Did you see his family?" And there's just a very consistent between the people I talked to, like, she was never around. Mm. So whatever their deal is, I think she knew when to not be around. And then he would use her to survivors. Like, "You have to go. Camille's on her way." Like, there's a sense of like they understood that Camille meant I have to leave.
Yeah, but that probably wasn't even true.
I'm sure. I mean, yeah, I don't think that's a real sense of, like, I think he just, you know, he's doing whatever it takes to get this person out of his house.
Right. So,
but like, this is the thing I did not know until we started doing the doc, that Cosby had a history of bullying reporters and calling reporters and demanding retractions and threatening people's jobs, even though he didn't have the ability to threaten their job. And Mark Lamont Hill tells a story. He's a professor at Temple about how Cosby called.
That guy was good.
Yeah. Mark's great. He's an underrated resource.
And so was that, that woman, that the other,
Kiernan Mayo.
Wow.
Yeah. No, at some point I was like, I don't know if Showtime is going to be famous people, but we have good conversations in here.
Oh, yeah.
And we have people who speak well.
And thinkers.
And big thinkers and people who are clearly wrestling with it while I talk to them. And once Showtime was down, once they said, well, they were always supportive, but once they were down, once they saw it and they let us do the survivors sort of without extra music, without archival, without recreation, they just let the women talk. It was like, well, I know we have something here.
All right. So you do all this and you get these amazing, like this sort of respect and time given to the survivors and to all types of people trying in wrestling and assessing it, both from, you know, a female point of view, a male point of view, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
All fluid point of view.
Yeah.
You know, but when you're doing this, he's in jail. Yeah. So on some level, these people are speaking from a place where a certain amount of justice has been doled out.
Yeah.
Handed it. Justice has been served.
Yeah.
And then, you know, before you finish it, he gets out.
Yeah,
on a technicality, right?
I mean, I just want to be clear. A lawyers say it's not a technicality, but it is the way that most of us who are not lawyers understand it as a technicality,
right?
Lawyers say it's like the truth is that he struck a deal with one DA, DA. That deal, the next DA came in and basically was like, I'm going to put Bill Cosby in prison. So he violates the deal. And then a new person comes in who goes, no, now I'm going to go back to the original deal. So he's got to get out of prison. So it was like the part that is ridiculous.
You think power afforded him that?
Yeah, I think the power 100%. Like, because first of all, the deal is involving the Andrea Constand case. And the deal was, if you do this deposition about her case, you can say whatever you want to say. And we won't prosecute you, which is not a deal that a person without power gets.
Yeah.
That's not a deal.
What's the point of that?
Because they were trying to wrap up Andrea Constand's case, and that was how they figured out to do it. You come in here and tell us what happened. You tell us, you answer our questions, and then we will be able to wrap up Andrea Constand's case, and then you can go on and live your life.
Huh.
And so that was Andrea Constand had a civil case against him, but it was like the idea being that, like, do this. And so he did it. And that's where he says in the deposition, I mean, there's a couple things he says. One, he admits to giving women quaaludes for sex, but you can read that as like they want to have sex or not.
It's a party, man.
But the thing he says that the doc lands on that I didn't know until I did the doc was about the fact that when he was with Andrea Constand and she is drugged, he says he's sort of approaching her, however you want to put it. He says, I enter the space between permission and rejection, and I'm not stopped. And as far as I'm concerned, I was like, that's the game. That's not a thing.
Yeah.
There's no space between permission and rejection, especially if you've drugged somebody already.
Yeah.
So that for me, it's like, that's him admitting to his what he does.
Mm.
And I don't think a lot of people had heard that way before.
Yeah.
And so that to me was like, I know a lot of people focus on the first part, but I want to focus on the second part. But yes.
And
then he gets out. So to be Kiernan Mayo, Michael Cord, who's a Philly lawyer. And we did another second interview with Mark Lamont that we did after he got out of prison.
What was your feeling then? Like what happened for you when that happened? Cause you were like nearing the end of the work, right?
Yeah. We thought we were like our last day of filming and we were in Philly.
Yeah.
And none of us, there was no sense that this might happen. We didn't go to Philly cause we thought it would happen. And I got a text message from a mutual friend of ours who's a comedian.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I can tell you later. Cause he was like, your doc just got more interesting. And I was like, I run out of the bathroom like, everybody, I have news. But of course everybody was on their phone. And I was like, I don't know what this is anymore. Is it done?
Yeah.
And because there are Cosby docs out there that have gotten to a place. There's one I know that I heard that is finished. but it just stopped. But it's just sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Huh.
So I just like, maybe this is what happens. Maybe it's done. Also, maybe it should be done, because maybe it's not going to, maybe this is really not a good idea for me to do this anymore.
So you thought like you had nothing.
Well, I just thought that the story was too complicated and also too charged now that he was out. Like, maybe legally we can't do it. I don't know what any, like, especially the we had just heard he was out of prison, but he wasn't exonerated, which I didn't understand at that moment. Like, maybe we can't say anything. Maybe you have to put alleged before everything was
But he added. Wasn't exonerated.
No, he wasn't exonerated. It was just about the deal being violated, the deal for him to say whatever he wanted to say in the deposition. It wasn't about his guilt or innocence.
Huh. Did you try to reach out to him?
No.
No point.
There was a lot of talk. There was sort of, we talked about it.
Yeah.
But one, it was always about the conversation around Bill Cosby, not a conversation with Bill Cosby. There is plenty of Bill Cosby footage in there. He's never wavered from what he says. He's completely innocent. I don't believe that. And I don't think I can have a real, I can't have a conversation about his career.
No.
And
it would have to be pointed.
All the women who were invited in.
You're going to do that to them?
No, I'm not going to
sit there and go, I didn't do it.
Yeah, and have them go, I know I told you that he wasn't going to be in it, but now that he's out.
Yeah, and guess what? He says he didn't do it.
Yeah, he also said that he named you by name and da da da, and there's a lawyer there. And,
yeah.
And to me, it was just like, that's not what this is.
Exactly. So after that happens, mm-hmm. So you're sort of left with, you know, everything you've done. You've got mm-hmm. the 4 hours of this that you mm-hmm. put together, and what you're really left with is, I still have to figure out.
Yeah.
I do with this, these two sides of this guy.
You'll appreciate this sort of version of it. I thought of it as I started saying this out loud, this is like the TV show Chopped. These are the ingredients I have.
Yeah.
I have to make them into something.
Well, do you think that, you know, because like now that we're talking about it, it feels to me that culturally there is a verdict. And that for the most part, you know, people believe it.
I would say that, I mean, you know, that there's a large percentage of people who believe the survivors, but they haven't. I think the doc, if they watch it, makes them dig into it and believe in a different way.
Yeah. And also, but, you know, I think that one thing that it may address that isn't really spoken is that, you know, all the people that loved him, you know, there's a shame equation to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a shame equation to continuing to love him mm-hmm. in light of it.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's a hard reckoning for an mm-hmm. individual, even if it's not that important or upfront. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to love somebody you believe did horrible things repeatedly and still have empathy for the victims, and I mean the survivors,
mm-hmm.
there's got to be shame in that.
Well, and I think that we had a section that we had to pull out for time, mostly, where we asked everybody, would you watch the stuff again? Would you show it to kids? And so we had lots of people go through how they would reckon with it.
Like what stuff?
Like, would you show episodes of The Cosby Show to kids in your life?
Uh-huh.
Would you listen to him do stand-up again?
Uh-huh.
Do you do this?
Uh-huh.
And the idea is sort of to show like how people are reckoning with it. And it's all very, everybody has their own way. Most people said no, but then we had people say yes. But the idea being that like, and this is what I sort of come to now, is that first of all, we all separate art from the artist all the time, just in ways that we don't think about.
Yeah, because we don't know a lot, too.
Well, we don't know, or we don't judge the thing that some things we don't judge as harsh, other people are judging as harsh.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think of much, and I'm doing this on purpose, Eric Clapton right now. Like, there's a whole lot of, like,
yeah.
I didn't know the racist story from the past. He's an anti-vaxxer coronavirus conspiracy guy, but right. He has 40 years of music that I've loved.
Yeah.
And so, well, not me.
Yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know what you're saying.
Hendrix was always better. I don't know.
I have problems with Clapton other than that, but I know what you're saying.
But the idea that like we are sort of, we do it a lot, but the problem with the Cosby thing is, and this is a problem with generally, is that when somebody else doesn't separate it the way you do, then people, that's where the problem lies. And I think what we have to have empathy for the fact that like, I'm going to separate it here, but that doesn't mean other people are going to separate it in the same place. And right now, we spend a lot of time arguing about these lines on social media in ways that aren't productive. And what I'm saying is like, look, here's how I feel about it. I can think positively about some of the stuff that Cosby did, but I'm not ever going to forget about the survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a universe in which I show my three daughters at some point that scene from The Cosby Show where they're doing the lip sync of Ray Charles. Yeah. Because that's like in me, like how some people feel about the moon landing. That's in me.
Hmm.
But I'm definitely going to contextualize it. It's in whatever age-appropriate way is necessary at that point.
But, you know, it's like, I think that's one of the things that, like, you know, as much as I like the documentary and I like you, it's tricky.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, I get what you're saying, and I get that you're saying that, you know, we do it all the time with art and artists, but like, whatever Clapton's transgressions are, they're not 60 rapes.
No. I'm not saying that.
I'm saying even without the Clapton example, like, I'm trying to picture you showing your kids this and then trying to say, like, there's a problem with this guy.
I mean, I feel like I've done this with my kids. There's a problem with America.
Okay.
Like,
but America's not, you know, doing the Ray Charles lip syncing.
Yeah, but America has. Here's the good thing about this country. I mean, okay. I think this is what I feel about. So there are some people who are like, why would a black man tear down a black man? Why would you do why? Blah blah blah. All these.
I don't think you're tearing him down. I think that's.
I think people who say that haven't seen it. But,
yeah, but I also think you're just, you know, contextualized.
Yeah, but I feel like this, like, as a black person in this country, and this is even true of Jews, we have the ability to go, here's the good part about America.
Yeah.
Here's the bad part about America.
Yeah.
And you have the ability to hold that.
And the bad part is winning.
I feel fair. I've looked into New Zealand a lot. Please, yeah. New Zealand, hit me up. But like, I think it's about, we do that regularly where you go, this is the, you know, greatest country on earth. I mean, that's not true.
But we
sort of grew up in this greatest country on earth.
Believe it.
And also, don't go down that street because they don't like your people down that street.
Sure.
And so I think
state.
Yeah, this is don't go down that state. But I do think that, like, I'm not saying, like, today I'm going home to play this thing for my 10-year-old. I'm saying there is some point in her life where it might come across her face and I have to go, yeah, and?
Right.
Or... Yeah. Somehow it comes up in conversation, like, where it's like, and this has happened, you know, we've sat and watched all sorts of things where it's like, these people aren't good people. And I think kids are actually more capable of understanding that, or these people did bad things.
Uh-huh.
Kids are capable of understanding that because they do bad things, but they're not bad people.
Yeah, I understand.
But I understand. But here's the thing. I'm not. Here's what I'm saying. All this stuff dies on the vine. All comedy dies on the vine. Eventually, nobody's paying attention to the biggest, you know, whatever. But right now, as a person, as people of my generation, especially if you're black, if that Cosby stuff is in you, you have to. I can recognize that it's in me.
Mm.
And I can recognize that even when I watched for the purposes of this doc and I sat and would watch, like, The Dentist, I would be like, man, look what he did there.
Yeah.
But that doesn't for a second. That's why I always talked about the other shoe dropping mean that I'm going to, one, forget about the survivors, or two, I'm not going to tweet out, everybody, I know there's a lot out there about Bill Cosby, but watch this clip from himself.
Yeah.
I know. I get it. But I mean,
if,
for a second, because that would be naive and dumb on my part to do that.
Yeah.
So, but I don't think sitting here sitting with myself, talking to trusted people in my life, I always talk about the way you text people in the group chat is not how you speak in the world.
Yeah.
That there are ways to have those conversations that are ultimately, and for me, the purpose of having it is to go, what can we learn from this? And specifically with Cosby and show business, how do we limit the damage of this?
Right. But this is also an argument to be made for that woman's interpretation, the psychological interpretation that, like, yes, all this may be true, but clearly this guy was putting on a show to cover up the fact that he liked to do this other thing. And
yes,
Renee
Graham. Yeah.
That's another way to teach your kids about show business.
Exactly.
You know, because the lesson you're trying to like, the thing is like, there is a way to have empathy for survivors, to present this guy as a guy who was a progressive and important voice.
Yeah.
And also, you know, had this horrible sickness, this evil compulsion.
I don't even want to put it on, because I feel like sickness makes it sound like that he's...
Okay, this evil compulsion.
He did these things, yes.
This predatory nature,
you
know, but like, it's a delicate line, because you're saying that how do we shift the environment?
Yeah.
How do we make the environment so this doesn't happen when so much about, you know, the ego of performing is about getting this love or doing these things or having this freedom to take liberties that are predatory and disgusting? You know, what becomes of it all if you can't just pathologize people and say, like, that guy was a fuck the way around?
This is how I think about it, is that I think showbiz encourages everybody below the top of the call sheet to look the other way, just generally.
Right, but what Mo Ryan was speaking to, and what is correct is that she said is that this is a It's intentional corporate oversight.
Yes.
In the name of profit.
And I was happy that she said it. And she said, toss that whole industry into the motherfucking sun, which was like my, like, I want that on a t-shirt. Yes. I really did not want this to, and it may have skewed this way because it's about Cosby, to be about one bad guy. It's about one bad guy in an industry that allowed him to be a bad guy.
Yeah, but
the corporate decision making about
the corporate decision making is like, we get it.
Yeah,
you know, there's a problem.
Yeah,
but we can still make a little money. Still make a little money
for sure. And I think, you know, the thing that I've been saying is that, you know, when they built show business, they didn't go, before we start making dreams, where do we put the human resources department?
No,
that's, and so for me, it's about like prioritizing that version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
That priority go
before,
and like
we start making dreams, we got to realize there's going to be a lot of dream debris.
Exactly. Yeah, and we need to figure out, what do we do with all that dream debris. The off gas of dreams,
the broken hearts and busted people.
Yeah,
criminal intentions.
And showbiz has never done a good job of that. And we come out of the comedy club world where it's like, you know, where there's like, you've seen the thing on the, like in the green where it says don't have sex with the wait staff or whatever, and that's the human resources department. Don't do that.
Yeah, someone's not coming back to this club again.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so now what? What's the pushback then?
I mean, you know, I have like, I, you know, I've withdrawn from lots of social media just because there's no reason to sort of like, I mean, to be fair, I don't read all the good reviews either, but I definitely am like, I stumbled across, and I didn't watch it, but like YouTube, because it knows I care about Bill Cosby and me, will share, look at this video, an hour and a half long video about how W. Kamau Bell is the guy we need to talk about, not Bill Cosby. And
why?
And you just go, all right, I'm going to go ahead and just skip that one. Yeah, you know, there are certainly,
that's the worst.
There are certainly people, and I've seen some articles because I get Showtime shares like the breaks of of all the things that are coming out, and they're not all good. But there are certainly people in show business and people out of show business and people, cultural commentators, and many whom are black who I don't believe have seen it. But even they have, you know, there's videos where, you know, I'm a sellout, or I'm an industry shill, or I've been hired to take down a black man.
Uh-huh.
And again, if you see it, you know, I'm not taking down a black man. Yeah. But also, like, there's been people who are like, even if he did those bad things, why are we talking about it now? What's the point?
Yeah.
And for me, it's like America does a good job of never thinking it's time to have the big conversation. Uh-huh. So I just feel like we're talking about it now because we're talking about it now, and it needs to be talked about. And if you don't, and the thing I've said that I've seen clipped in other places is like what we're doing, because there's also this idea that this is all white women. It's not. We address that in the piece, that if you say we don't want to, if you're prioritizing this one black man's voice, a third of the survivors are black women. Why are we prioritizing his voice over their voices? And so for me, it's like the pushback is from a type of person who is always going to ride for black men over black women. And also made more complicated by the fact that the black guy who made it is married to a white woman.
Mm.
So like I'm not, from a lot of people that off top, I can't be trusted.
Huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you're carrying a lot.
I'm carrying, this is not I didn't release a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
You know, and I also understand that like what I'm getting is not anything close to what a lot of the survivors get, but they have actually reached out to me to sort of see they got my back. So it's great. But yeah, it is. There's a part of this that is like, it's the best reviewed thing I've ever released. It's the most acclaimed anything I've ever gotten that I've released, but I can't just sit here and celebrate it because it's about some pretty intense shit. That for the rest of my life, there I'm going to walk into rooms and have some people go, that motherfucker.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I say that to my wife and my friends, like, yeah, I can't, because there is some sense of like, yay. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I'll ever be there. I'm happy that there are people receiving the work the way it was intended. I'm happy that the survivors who are in it, all I've heard from have been like, are really appreciated and they've been able to watch it, even though it's not just about that. So I feel like there is building that can come off this work, and people feel like I accomplished a very difficult thing to do in some sense, and I know it's not perfect, but it's also like, you know, as I said to my best friend Jason, I'm like, well, at least I'm not the black guy who talked to the Klan anymore. Like my obit is going to have a different starting line now.
Well, I mean, I think these are just it's the cost of doing something like this. It's the cost of putting yourself out there, taking the risk, and you know, and trying to present something in a journalistic way that's provocative. It's always going to be, you know, this fucking guy.
Yeah, no, and I the funny thing for me is that like I'm literally just a dude who was like, I love Bill Cosby and I love Eddie Murphy and I hope one day to be on Saturday Night Live. Like that was, that's where this all started. That's where this all started. So
your career in comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just was like, I sit here sometimes like, how did this, like whose idea was this?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, you know, a quest for, you know, justice in general. I mean, a quest for, you know, the progress.
Well, yeah, these are ideas I would be wrestling with on my own.
That's what you grew up with.
And now I'm in the position where I can wrestle with them in my work. So yeah. It's not like somebody came to me, like some people were like, Hollywood made him do this or white Hollywood. No.
You and Eddie Murphy and Bill Cosby and SNL, you know, by the time you started doing stand up, that wasn't what you were doing.
No, it was, it just,
you were
was,
doing
was,
the other thing.
It was too late. Yeah, it was too late. It was too late.
Yeah. I got shit to talk about.
It was like, I got to find my truth and I got to find my voice because I read Prior Convictions and Richard Pryor said it's all about finding your voice. So I got to find the comedy octopus, I think he called it. I got to figure out find out. Yeah. So I was always headed down if I didn't know
the truth path.
Yeah.
Good talking to you, man. Good job.
Thanks, man.
There you go. That's it. We Need to Talk About Cosby is now available on Showtime. Always good to see Kamau. I'm alive. I hope you're well. Here's some guitar, like usual. It's probably something you've heard from me before. I don't know anymore. Enjoy. Monkey in La Fonda, cat angels everywhere. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me. A tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.